Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called Noble Rot, Wines from Another Galaxy by Dan Keeling and Mark Andrews. And one thing I notice in, a lot of the books that I review is that there are a lot of celebrity endorsements or little quotes in the beginning of the book to kind of lure you in and convince you that what you're about to read is amazing. This book is no exception to that rule, and one of my favorite quotes comes from one of my favorite musicians, Mike Diamond, also known as Mike D from the Beastie Boys. And he has this really compelling quote, and I want to share it with you because there's, you know, a challenge that he's throwing out. He says, "Good news, party people, not only will you love reading Wine from Another Galaxy, you will start to enjoy learning about and drinking wine more. And, wait for it, if you're not satisfied, I will personally buy you a glass of something delicious, no questions asked." So you heard it here first, folks. Mike D is guaranteeing, irrespective of my review, if you buy this book and you don't love it, he will buy you a glass of wine, something delicious. So you can reach out to him at mikeD@beastieboys.com. I'm kidding, that's totally not his email address. But I think that's a strong guarantee. And I won't tell you what I thought or if I'm going to try to hit him up for a glass of something delicious. I'd probably just do that anyway. But to me, it set a good tone for this book. This episode is brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. Y'all, did you know that Napa Valley represents 0.4% of the world's wine production? There are 44,210 acres under cultivation, and 92% of Napa Valley's wineries are family-owned. The vineyards range in elevation from sea level to 2,600 feet, and there are more than 40 grape varieties grown in Napa County. Find out more at napavalley.wine, and also check out the Napa Valley Sessions, which are hosted by knowledgeable moderators that engage in conversation with local Napa wine producers. That's napavalley.wine. So this is a big book. It came out in 2020. And in terms of what it looks like, I have a hardback cover and it's kind of like a matte black. And then in sort of like a holographic blue aqua color, it says in very large font, Noble Rot, Wine from Another Galaxy. Now, I'll just preempt myself from saying this because I don't want to even mention this in things I don't like about this book. But there's this trend in wine books to have these like beautiful matte covers. And then the minute you eat a snack or pick up a glass that has condensation on it, and then you flip through the book, your paw prints get all over it. And this book, I've read it once, and it's just kind of, I don't know, my hands aren't especially gross or anything like that, but there's just something about the finish that like it gets all smudgy and kind of yucky looking. I'm not a fan of that. So I just have to get that out of the way because I was telling you what the cover looks like, and the cover of my book looks kind of junky right now. But let's talk about Noble Rot. So first of all, Noble Rot has several meanings in the context of this book. For what it's worth, the two authors, and I want to give you a little bit of background on who they are. So Noble Rot is a magazine. The two co-authors founded it, and it was founded in 2013. It's a London-based kind of like food and wine and art and music magazine. It's published every 4 months. And was launched in 2013. It costs about £10 to get an issue of it. And so there are certain retailers all around the country who can just like buy a hard copy. I looked online. It doesn't look like you can just like straight up subscribe, but maybe that was just me kind of flailing. So it's this magazine all about wine and then other things, food, music, whatever, with lots of contributing writers. But these guys have some serious credentials. They also founded restaurants by the same name. Noble Rot is a restaurant and a magazine and now a book in two different locations in London. Dan Keeling, one of the two authors, has won 3 Louis Roederer Awards for wine writing. Now, this is a prestigious category and award. It no longer exists. It's now defunct, but you know, some really heavy hitters in the world of wine journalism have won some of these awards. And Dan also, before he got into wine, this is what I kind of love because it comes into this book throughout it, in a previous career, and lots of us in the wine industry came from other careers, he was in the music industry. He was the managing director of a record company and the head of A&R at another company where he signed Coldplay and Bombay Bicycle Club, among other acts. So throughout this book, there's a lot of reference to the music industry, which I know nothing about, but it's kind of cool that that's where his, you know, kind of perspectives kind of adjusted and shifted. And there's some neat stories that he tells as a result of it. Mark Andrew, the other author, is a master of wine, which is one of the highest credentials in the world of wine. And unlike a master sommelier credential, one of the things that's really key to obtaining your MW is it requires a lot of writing. And so that's not something that, you know, all wine professionals are comfortable doing, researching and writing like thesis style papers. So these are really interesting folks. And they have their own wine merchant in London. And then they have this book, this magazine, and then these restaurants. But that is not all that noble rot is. So a little bit of wine education time. You may have heard the term noble rot. And noble rot actually is, well, it's a fungal situation that exists when we're growing grapes and making wine. So noble rot is the beneficial sort of side of a fungus called Botrytis cinerea. And this is a fungus that can attack grapes if the conditions are ripe for its development. And in the right time, at the right place, and by that I mean with grapes that can benefit from the effects of this rot, and if they're fully ripe, then if this fungus happens, it needs natural situations to kind of come together in the perfect synergy. And that usually means like cool, misty, humid mornings and then warm, dry afternoons. And this fungus will attack clusters of ripe grapes, grape by grape, individually, and it pierces the skin and it dehydrates the grapes. It's a gradual process. And what happens is the grapes slowly shrivel and they turn into these kind of nasty looking moldy raisins. So the water content in the pulp of the grape is decreased, but the sugar and acid content maintains its naturally high level. So you get these moldy little raisins, and it has several effects on the flavors of the juice that you get as a result. So you don't get very much juice because the grapes get dehydrated. But if you press these grapes and then you ferment that juice into wine, then it can contribute aromas and flavors of like honey and ginger and saffron and really delicious characteristics. Now, these are only beneficial for certain types of grapes, typically white grapes. And some of the grapes that are most closely associated with the beneficial Botrytis are things like Riesling or Chenin Blanc or Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. So some of the world's great sweet wines, like, you know, Sauternes or like a Bernaschlaeser, Trockenbernaschlaeser Riesling, or sweet wines from the Loire Valley, they may have been affected by Botrytis, and classically they have been. Now, again, they're not necessarily made every single year because the conditions have to be right, but because the fungus attacks grape by grape, it's a really laborious process, and folks will actually pick individual berries as they go through the vineyard rather than collecting whole clusters. So it's super labor intensive, all done by hand, and it's rare. And the result is you can get these amazing, sweet, luscious wines that can age well. Now, on the flip side, if it happens to the wrong grapes at the wrong time, i.e. grapes that shouldn't display any characteristics of Botrytis, or like red grapes, we consider it gray rot, and the wine can, if it's at the wrong time and the wrong grapes, the wine will just taste like mold and there's nothing that can be done to save it. So it could be a blessing, it could be a curse. You just sort of never know, and you can't control it, you can't make it happen, you just sort of hope that everything works out. So the fact that this is a book and a magazine and a restaurant, it's also just a natural viticultural phenomenon in the world of wine. And it's kind of nice because we think of it as something that's like beautiful and great, but also kind of like gnarly and gross. And it's just a naturally existing contrast in the world of wine. So there's your little bit of education on Botrytis, but also the origin name of this book in particular. So this is a big book. It's 345 pages. That does not include the index, but it does include a glossary. And it seems really big at first. It's like, maybe it's like 7 by 9 in terms of dimensions, but it's a thick book. Like you could definitely use it as a doorstop. But it's full of beautiful pictures. And so I didn't bother, but if you take out all of the pictures, which sometimes are like 2-page spreads of producers or vineyards, it is actually a pretty manageable size book. It's not as, you know, it's not as large as it appears, I guess is what I'm saying. So in terms of how the book is arranged, it's arranged roughly in a chronology. So there's, you know, a foreword and an introduction. And then there's a like a more condensed first part called Shrine to the Vine. And it does, like so many wine books, cover very quickly some like relatively basic wine know-how. Things like how to order wine in a restaurant, or how wine is made, or basic grapes, how to assess wine, the lexicon. This is not necessarily a beginner's primer or how-to. It sort of seems like it is because of the subjects, like how wine is made. But as I looked a little closer, it moves very quickly. It doesn't necessarily define all the terms, though there is a glossary at the end. And it talks about things on a fairly high level. And so it's like it's checking off the boxes and covering its bases of doing an educational explanatory kind of preamble. But if you know nothing of wine, you would probably want to cross-reference something. It's basic, but also not elementary. It assumes a certain level of knowledge. That said, it's some pretty good information. One of the things I also really like in this first part, this Shrine to the Vine, is there are some like unusual suggestions in there. One of my favorite is they talk about recipes and food and wine pairing, and this makes sense, right? These guys own a restaurant. And one of my favorite styles of pairing wine and food is sort of I call it a high-low pairing. There's a million different ways to describe it. But if you imagine like super high-end, fancy, expensive, rare wine, and they use, you know, some of the single vineyard Domaine de la Romanée Conti wines as an example, like Latache. Like if you have a wine that is so divine and so rare and so special, like that's the star of the show. So you're not necessarily trying to prepare a dish that is going to try to be as rare, special, exciting, whatever. You almost want something delicious and simple so you can highlight the glory of the wine. So something like a delicious roast chicken. And roast chicken in Burgundy is a match made in heaven as far as I'm concerned. But you actually present a little, you know, three-course menu of with pictures of some pretty simple food that you could make at home that is very well paired with lots of different styles of wine. I am not a cook. I know how to read and I have a kitchen, so I could cook. I just choose not to, I guess. I mean, I can feed myself, but like I don't prepare elaborate multi-course menus or anything like that. But I almost feel after reading what they put in there, it's straightforward, it's wine focused. I could probably put together that meal. And I just thought it was kind of neat. It's not cutesy. It's not simple. It's sophisticated flavors, but it's a nice idea to showcase that if you are doing a wine-focused meal, let the wine be the star and let the food play a supporting role. And as a sommelier, I am here for that argument 100%. There are some good kind of interesting little tidbits kind of scattered throughout, but there are, you know, like I said, in the beginning, this shrine to the vine, it's kind of some simple stuff. There is a one page or like two page spread and it's entitled What Makes a Difference. And they say, and I like this a lot, that numerous factors affect the quality and style of a finished wine, whether it's world-class Northern Rhone Syrah or low quality Sauvignon Blanc. Variability of the following 11 items are key. And it's things that, of course, anyone who knows just the basics about wine might assume would influence the finished wine. The soil, the vines, the skill and the resources of the grape grower, climactic conditions that year, whether there were diseases, perhaps even botrytis. And then it moves on in terms of any type of aging or élevage before the wine was bottled, the care with which bottling is done and the quality of the closures, that's really important, the delivery and storage of the wine. And then the last one is the care with which the wine is brought to the table and served. And I like that because we always talk about the characteristics of a wine and like what makes a wine great. And we do mostly focus about what happens in the vineyard and what happens in the winery, which is obviously paramount. But all of that is for naught if you are not smart about how you cellar or store or open or serve the wine. You could actually kind of ruin somebody's hard and loving work. And I think it's just their perspective, again, of people who work in kind of both sides of the industry, sort of the front and the back of the house, as it were. So there is the lexicon of usefulness is also part of the shrine to the vine. And I really like this because I think this is one of the most intimidating things for folks who are trying to talk about wine. Obviously, the more wine you drink, the easier it is to talk about it. The words certainly start flowing. But there are terms that maybe imply something technical that could use a little bit of decoding. And they do start off this section with something that I really wanted to repeat. And they say that in the first issue of their Noble Rot magazine, they asked, like a rhetorical question to their readers, whether writing about wine was as futile as writing about music, something which Frank Zappa once likened, writing about music, to dancing about architecture. It kind of puts it into a clever perspective because wine's primary, you know, to fulfill its destiny, it just needs to be consumed, right? You need to drink it, to smell it, to taste it. So writing about it is sort of secondary. It's not critical to wine's existence and enjoyment. And I just thought that was kind of a clever quote. And again, these are guys, or at least one of them has a background in music. And so writing about wine is like dancing about architecture, if we want to make a couple of jumps there. But also we're talking about a book. So we're going to look at it. And so they talk about terms, and I'll just list a couple because it's not huge. These are small sections: energy, texture, harmony, freshness, layers, originality. And that might sound a little bit like poetic and kind of like out there. Like, what do people mean by that? But specifically, freshness is one of my favorites because it actually implies something structural about the wine. And I found throughout my career that depending on where you are in the world, certain people use certain terms. So when a person in wine, whether it's a consumer or a winemaker, describes a wine as fresh, what I hear and what they generally mean is the wine has elevated levels of acidity. And the reason we describe that as being fresh is because your body's response to acidity is first for your mouth to water. So if you think about something refreshing, like drinking a cold, not too sweet lemonade on a hot day, that's a refreshing beverage. And the acidity from the lemons are going to make your mouth water and it's just going to be very thirst quenching. And so wine is naturally acidic. All wine is. Some are more acidic than others based on grape variety and provenance. But I found specifically European winemakers, when they talk about a wine and they're like, oh, it's fresh. And that doesn't mean it's not old, like it's stale. It means elevated levels of acidity. So I kind of like this little section because it's not exactly like a debunking section, but there's a lot of kind of inside baseball terms that, whether intentionally or not, people use when they talk about wine. So it's good to understand what some of those terms mean. It's not just people writing, you know, kind of fruity notes and trying to be eccentric. There actually is a connotation to some of these terms. So there's a section in this book, again, in The Shrine to Wine, about aging wine. And first of all, it's important to note that the majority of wine that is produced and meant to be consumed is not destined for long aging. Most everything that you can that is produced, you should just go ahead and drink as soon as you can buy it. It's a very small subset of the world of wine that actually has the balance, the intensity, the concentration, and the structural characteristics that can benefit from very long aging. And one of the world's arguably great restaurants is in Paris, and it's called La Tour d'Argent. I've never been. They have probably one of the most famous Instagrammed wine lists because it's like 5 inches thick. It's like this giant tome. When I talk about a doorstop, like that would be a doorstop. Like you could potentially spend your entire meal just like flipping through it and you wouldn't get through it. But they interview the head sommelier who's been there for decades. And they have one of the most, obviously with a list that big, one of the biggest and deepest cellars in the world. And one of the things that is such a treat, from what I understand, what I've read and what I've seen, is that places like this, they have extensive collections of aged wine. And the sommelier talks, you know, he's a great resource to talk in this section on how wine ages and can it age. And he talks about how sometimes there's a risk that if you go into a restaurant, you see a lot of old wine that maybe they just haven't been able to sell it. And like, who knows if it's any good. And if you know the producer and the vintage, like maybe you've done some homework. But he actually says that they try to sell the weaker vintages when they're younger. And so if you do see the older vintages, again, maybe we'll have to take a field trip to La Tour d'Argent. Maybe that's what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll hit up Mike D and tell him I didn't like this book. I'll be like, let's go to Paris. And I know what I want you to buy me a glass of. JK. But you know, I think that's a really interesting point because old wine for old wine's sake both does not appeal to me, nor does it appeal to the sommelier. So the weaker vintages that maybe don't have the intensity, the complexity to develop for decades on end, they try to push them out a little bit earlier when they're still in their prime because they're just not going to improve. Whereas there are some wines that will, you know, develop years on end. And it goes into this cool story. And these two guys, they have traveled about and they have some amazing stories in this book. But in particular, they detail in this section about a visit to champagne producer Paul Roget and how they had had a cave-in of one of their cellars and lots of finished wine in their cellar had been just buried. And when they were invited to the Maison, because they had excavated some of this wine. And so they had the opportunity to taste really old champagne. And if you've been listening all season and for all of the seasons, you've definitely heard me talk about champagne and how the styles of champagne have evolved over the years. And so to be able to drink a 125-year-old bottle of champagne, one, that's quite old. High quality champagne does have the ability to age for decades. But 125 years ago, the style of champagne was very different. It was much, much sweeter. And so it's come up in a couple podcasts because people reference it and they reference it here, shipwreck champagne from boats that were bombed or torpedoed rather in like the early part of the 20th century. A lot of times they had wine cellars on board. And when those have been brought to the surface and excavated, if the wine is sound, champagne-wise, it's also very, very sweet. Well, they had two bottles of this 125-year-old Paul Roget, and it's always a gamble, right? With really, really old wine, and they describe it. And you kind of cross your fingers and you really hope. They opened the first bottle. And at this point, you know, a bottle of champagne that's this old, you wouldn't expect to have any bubbles. And predictably, it had no fizz whatsoever, but was, you know, described as kind of being golden in color, which is generally positive because all wines will turn brown with age. And so if the wine was relatively still light in color, like that's a potential good sign. However, gradually decrepit aromas of grandpa's musty old wardrobe unfurl. This wine was not so much over the hill as 6 feet under the mountain. Sad times, right? So very cool opportunity to try some super old wine, but they had two bottles. So second bottle, they had one and predictably it was quite sweet. There was no fizz, but they go on to offer tasting notes and descriptions and it looks like, reads like, and is described as a wine that's still in condition, which is kind of exciting. I mean, that's just one of the fun things. It's time traveling. And there isn't so much of that in this book where I wouldn't liken it to Jancis Robinson or Steven Spurrier when they talk about these epic tastings that they've attended. These fellas definitely have tasted a lot of wine. They've done a lot of traveling, but it's not like there's huge tasting after tasting described. So it's a different style. It's just kind of interspersed in more of a anecdotal style. They do talk about, as restaurateurs, other restaurants. And I love and hate this. They talk about the wines that they love to drink there and some of the greatest restaurants in the world. And it's great because if you are someone who can travel and you have the means, then this is a who's who of where to dine. But it's also pretty exclusive. And, you know, the more we talk of it, there's a phenomenon on social media that we talk about a lot with sommeliers where it's like these super Instagrammable bottles. And a lot of these bottles, a lot of these wines that, you know, get so popular and so many likes among the small wine community, there's not a ton that's produced. And so the more popular it gets, the harder it is to ever get them. And so it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy that like, ooh, look at this unicorn bottle that I just found. It's so rare. It's so hard to see. And then everyone wants it. And then it's going to be even rarer and harder to get if you ever get a taste. So I kind of love and hate when they put in these recommendations, but I'm going to do a little shameless pat on the back. I have been to a couple of these restaurants, not La Tour d'Argent, but they detail a great restaurant in Chablis, which is the northernmost part of France. And it's not open anymore. It closed down, which is really sad. I mean, when great restaurants cease to exist, it is super sad. But my last trip to Champagne a couple of years ago, I took a couple extra days and rented a car and drove to Chablis with some friends. And it was this great restaurant called Ophile du Zinc. And a friend of mine had recommended eating there. And then I had tasted with the producer and he asked where we were dining. And we mentioned that we were having dinner there and it got Christian Moreau's seal of approval. And I felt very cool about that. You know, I kind of love and hate that a very small amount of restaurants are featured because the majority of the world will never have the opportunity to dine and drink at these places, even the ones that are still open. So it's cool. If you've got the ability, you do have a roadmap. It's not a dining guide whatsoever. As we move along in this book, there's also something that I have yet to see, I don't think, in any other wine book I've yet reviewed, and I love it. And it's just a simple graphic, because there are lots of pictures in this book, and then there's also illustrations. They tend to be very brightly colored. It's modern, it's catchy. And what it does is it analyzes, and you have to remember, these are British folks, and so a lot of the terms, the money, the locations, it's all based on their reference. So they're comparing three different bottles of wine that cost £5, £10, and £50 a bottle. And what they do is they simply just break down the cost of the wine, what percentage of the total price the actual liquid inside the bottle cost, what the packaging cost, that would be the actual bottle, the box, shipper, a label, the closure, the logistics, say marketing and shipping, duty taxes, a retailer margin, whatever someone's going to mark it up for, and then the VAT or the value-added tax. And so, for example, the same categories are applied to these same different prices of wine. So the VAT changes, the tax is going to change, the retailer margin is certainly going to change. But what's interesting is the percentage of the total price. Packaging is, you know, you can have a 2-cent cork or a $2 cork, but that's not going to be the most expensive thing in a bottle of wine. But sometimes when I'm talking to folks about wine, I do say that, yeah, there is a little bit of a something you get what you pay for, because there are fixed costs in wine. And once you remove all of those out, you start to see what you pay for. So look, if you want to do your $2 chuck or your $3 chuck or $4, I'm not sure how many bucks the chuck is right now, but if you want to buy that, just know that if it comes in a glass bottle with a screw cap or a cork, and there's a retailer markup from whatever the wine, you know, came from the producer at, and you subtract all that out, what you're paying for is a very small amount for the exact same volume of wine, 750 milliliters. So the 5-pound bottle, just as a reminder, since the restaurant and the publication and these authors are all British, when I say 5-pound bottle of wine or 50-pound, I'm not talking about weight. I'm talking about the monetary unit. Okay, just want to make sure. It's a giant bottle of wine. No. These are all 750 milliliter bottles of wine that cost different amounts, but these are British guys. So the 5-pound bottle, the cost of the wine is 6% of the total price. For the 10-pound bottle, the cost of the wine is £2.24, 22% of the total price. For the 50-pound bottle, certainly a more luxurious bottle, the actual cost of the liquid is £20.53, which is 42% of the actual price. So what that means is that the money that was invested into the actual wine, the quality of the grapes and the harvesting and the winemaking and all of that stuff, it's actually very little of what you're paying for when you're buying super cheap wine. You're mostly paying for tax and shipping and the bottle. And if you care about what you put into your body, just know that you do get a little bit of something what you pay for. So yes, a 50-pound bottle is more expensive than a 5-pound bottle. but know that there's more money and more investment spent in the quality of grapes to make that wine. So I love that that was included because you don't see that so often. And they're also a wine merchant. And so their perspective, I think, is it's very fresh in this regard. Ooh, see what I did there? There's some freshness. There's a section, of course, talking about decanting, which is one of my favorite and most misunderstood things that we can do to wine. And there's nothing wrong with decanting wine, simply pouring wine from the bottle it came in into some other vessel. It could be a Kool-Aid pitcher. It could be a fine Zalto decanter. But the idea is, you know, maybe to adjust the temperature, separate the liquid from any sediment that's accumulated in the bottle. Maybe with a little bit of exposure to oxygen, help the wine become more aromatic, more flavorful. However, they do include this, again, as restaurateurs, they say that your sommelier should always ask whether or not you would like a wine decanted. This is true. You know, most of my adult life working as a sommelier. But they say, sommeliers don't always do that, as we found out at a restaurant with a famous and well-priced cellar in Baden, Germany. They ordered a bottle of 1981 Domaine de la Romanée Conti Romanée Saint-Vivant, which was priced at a fraction of the market value. So they were hunting Easter eggs. They were at a restaurant with a famous cellar. They saw a sick-ass bottle of wine, and they thought, yes, that's a good value. It was probably very expensive. It was also quite old. And Pinot Noir is a very delicate wine. People have very strong opinions on whether or not you should decant Pinot Noir. Some people say yes. Some people say no. Some producers, they mention Maria Teresa Mascarello, say that decanting her wines is sacrilege. Again, caveat emptor, like buyer beware, you can do whatever you want. But the sommelier at this restaurant did not inquire. These two folks know their wine and they ordered it. The sommelier, they say, how do they describe it? This sainted Pinot slowly met God in an unrequested decanter for over an hour while we finished our whites and was fit only for seasoning chips by the time it arrived in our glasses. So if you have really old, really nice Burgundy, if you want to decant it, that's up to you. But the longer it's open, the quicker it will fall apart. And if it's already old and already delicate, you don't want to keep it open. And it just makes me really sad to hear about that because that's not a wine I ever tasted, but that's basically a wine that you might as well pour down the drain because it was ruined. So I like that they include these little stories of their excursions and their kind of travels all throughout the world. So the Shrine to the Vine, it's maybe a quarter of the book. It's certainly not the largest section of the book. The largest section of the book is, well, it's fantastic. They call it the Rotter's Road Trip, Noble Rot, Rotter's Road Trip. And it is, you know, it took me a while to like kind of get on board because some of these things in the Shrine to Vine are not unique to this book. You can find them in many different wine books. But the Rotter's Road Trip is the people and places behind their favorite wines. And look, it's totally cool to pick favorites. It's one of the fun things about having a diverse palate and preferences. And so they jaunt all over the world. And it is such a lovely vignette, for lack of a better term, on all of these different producers all over the world. They spend a hefty amount of time in France. They go from the Loire Valley to Champagne through Burgundy. Then they go through the Jura. They go through the Rhone and Bordeaux to Southwest France. Then they hop over to Spain, go all throughout Spain, dip into Portugal, and then they bop over to Italy. They travel throughout some famous regions in Italy. And then they detail Germany, Greece, and then some British sparkling wine. And it's interesting because in a previous book from this season, Stephen Spurrier, Life and Wine, I talk about how he took this trip early on in his career when he was working for a wine merchant. And it was how he learned, like it was jealousy inducing for me to read about his major travels all over the world, just to stage and work for free and just get the experience and the tasting. And these guys do something similar. Now there's not a chronology exactly. It's not like they just took one giant road trip. I think it's just an amalgamation of trips and things like that. But it's just beautifully done. It incorporates stories and anecdotes and great pictures. There's a couple of famous wine festivals and parties like Dives Bouté or La Palais de Merceau, and they, you know, attended them. And there's just great pictures and some of the most like absolutely amazing quotes I've ever, like, they're such good writers. I really love the words that they use in these books. So one of my favorites is when they're talking about La Palais de Merceau. And I've never been to La Palais de Merceau, but it's this giant party. And if you are not a winemaker in Burgundy, you can attend as the guest of a winemaker in Burgundy. And La Palais has made its way to the United States and, you know, would bop back and forth between New York and San Francisco. And it's this big celebration of Burgundy. And attendees, it's like a best bottle, you know, party. and you bring your best bottle to share. It's a really cool idea. And obviously the bigger, the better, right? So if you're bringing large formats and you're bringing your sickest seller selections, like you're going to obviously be super, super popular. And they do detail, and this is like, it blows my mind. And I have literally tasted some of the best Burgundies I've ever tasted. Like I remember the first time I tasted Coach de Merceau and it did give me goosebumps. And I'm not exaggerating. Like I had a very physical response to it. Like it kind of took my breath away a little bit. It was special wine. And so they talk about the wine that they're drinking. And of course, you're sharing and it's a party. So it's like a little sip of this, a little sip of that. It's not full glasses because you want to kind of stretch your bottles and let as many people taste as possible. So they start off with champagne and then they move into Burgundy and they're talking about all of these amazing wines that they're tasting in quick succession, you know, Jacques Carignan Poulinier Montmorency, Premier Cru Le Perrier, or Jean-Marc Rouleau greets us with a magnum, wait for it, of 96 Merceau Premier Cru Perrier, Rouleau Perrier, Merceau Perrier, so great, in a magnum, great vintage. And this is how they describe it. And they said they wasted no time making room in one of their glasses because they needed to taste this wine, right? From Merceau's greatest vineyard in an outstanding year, 1996 Rouleau Perrier tastes like, I love this, this is so beautifully written, a mind-bogglingly complex concoction of honey, nuts, citrus, and mushrooms that grips the palate like buttered Velcro. I want so bad. I shall not find. But oh, I just read that and I like underlined it and I was like, I can taste the best Burgundies I've ever tasted. And just think about that. And then of course, like on the opposite leaf is just the party of everyone singing and like waving their napkins around. And it just, it's really beautifully written, but it also just, it sounds like so much fun and just so delicious. And again, writing about wine, it's like dancing about architecture, but every now and then, like you can just hit the nail on the head. When we skip forward a little bit further, there are a couple of other visits that I just absolutely loved. One of them, and it's really important that they visit Sauternes because Sauternes in Bordeaux, this great sweet white wine of Bordeaux, it is defined by the grapes being affected by botrytis. So these are sweet white wines made from Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. The book is called Noble Rot. Their restaurant is called Noble Rot. They obviously are going to be talking about wines that are affected by the Noble Rot. And one of the little stories that I love so much is they visit Chateau de Chem, which is easily the greatest producer of Sauternes on the planet. And I want to do this. I want to be in the position to be able to do what they did. And they say that it's not every day that a first growth welcomes you to lunch with a quote unquote specially created aperitif, even if it's a little joke. Made from equal parts Sauternes and crushed ice, given the wine in question didn't make the final blend of Chateau de Chem, arguably alongside Egon Müller's Trockenbären Auslese, the world's finest sweet wine, it is the most extravagant slush puppy we've ever tasted. So at Chateau de Chem, this is what they specialize in. They have recently started to make some dry white wines when they don't have the optimal conditions for botrytis. But what's happening there is they're sending pickers sometimes 12 different times throughout harvest through the vineyards to select these beautifully nobly rotten grapes and then press them and vinify that wine. And I guess they have some wine that is perfectly delicious, but didn't make it into the final blend. And they serve it over like, I'm only imagining like that crushed kind of like Pizza Hut pellet ice from my youth in the 80s and a Sauternes slushy. I am here for that. And if you're not here for that, like, I'm not entirely sure I don't want to know you. Maybe Mike D can get us one of those situations. I am really hung up on his offer to buy someone a glass of wine. I think it's really fantastic. But I've not been inside Chateau de Chem. I've been to Sauternes. I've been to producers. I've been to, you know, the chateau. I've like taken pictures of the vineyards and seen it from the outside looking in, nose pressed up against the glass like a a jealous young sommelier. But I really want to try making a slushy with it. You know, there was one thing that really stuck out in this book, not so much because of the author's take on this, but other books that I've recently read and reviewed. And you guys know I love champagne. I read a lot of books about champagne. And one of a couple of the books I've read are producers who are talking about sort of a new wave in champagne. And they're really heralding producers making single plot or single vineyard wines, which is not antithetical to the tradition in champagne, but it hasn't been the tradition in champagne. And what people have done for years in that region is combine wines made from different grapes, from different vineyards, from different villages, and from different vintages. The idea behind that being that in a marginal area where the quality can vary, if you combine all of these individual elements, the sum is greater than its individual parts. And a lot of kind of new school thought is that blending obscures terroir. And if you have a great plot, then you should just make a single vineyard wine. And I disagree with that on several levels. But I came across something in this book, which is going to be my new retort to that. So when in Italy, these guys are visiting the estate in Barolo, the Bartolo Mascarello estate. And Bartolo he is deceased, but his daughter, Maria Teresa, still makes the wine. It's very traditional Barolo. And one thing that they detail in here with no context or comparison to Champagne, but she makes wine in a very, very traditional way, like Chave in the Northern Rhone Valley. She believes the ultimate expression, and as does Chave, of the appellation is a blend of several different vineyards sited around the different hills. Maria Teresa insists that the only way for her to make her great Barolo is by blending her four individual vineyards, Canubi, San Lorenzo, Rue, and Roque, into one wine, as her dad, his father Giulio, and Giulio's father Bartolomeo did in their day. No one on the planet is going to knock Mascarello Barolo because it's a blend of different sites and say, that obscures terroir. That is not a true expression of the Nebbiolo grape. But many people have a huge problem with the same thing in Champagne. And Champagne and Barolo are not the same wines. But the argument is interesting. And so I present that to you for your consideration. And I love seeing that here. I've not been to Mascarello. I've certainly tasted the wines. And I just like being able to compare and contrast because it's apples and oranges, but also it's not. It's okay to take different approaches in the world of wine. And I just thought that was a really neat little tidbit, like one little paragraph in one tiny section in one part of this big, beautiful book all about wine. So what did I like about this book? Man, I liked a lot about this book. It was kind of a slow amp up, which, by the way, there is a quote from my girl, my homie, Jancis Robinson, about her favorite ways of tasting are like a crescendo where it slowly starts to rise and gets bigger and better as it goes on. And I think that that is a good way to describe this book. When I first cracked it open, I was like, this is just a flashy, like, I don't know, it's very colorful, it's very bright, and it covers a lot of the same kind of beginner wine topics that a lot of books do, which we don't need to reinvent the wheel endlessly. But as I got into it, man, I just really liked this book. I think it's an easy read. It is a big book, but it's broken up into these little, these producer profiles, but it's not just a straight technical producer profile. It's visits and conversations, and there's gorgeous photography of the sellers. And it's a combination of color and black and white, all on this like matte paper. It's not shiny. A lot of these producers are highly esteemed and regarded. One might argue that their 100 producers are certainly some of the world's 100 best producers. And like I said about the restaurants that they list, not everybody is going to have access to these wines. Certainly not going to be able to enjoy and taste some of the wines that they've tasted, but it's not showy. It's not braggadocious. It's just these guys travel and they eat and they drink and they love wine and they love these producers and they talk about them in just a lovely way. Like, I really want to go to their restaurant and order something off the list and just kind of like hang and see who I run into, or just go and hang and drink some delicious Beaujolais, by myself and eat some tasty noms. But there was a crescendo in terms of my interest and how like quickly of a page turner this became and how much I really love this book. So if you can't tell, I am a huge fan. This is 100% a buy. It's beautifully done. It's educational. And I think its real contribution in education lies in the producer profiles, which is part of their travel, because you do get to hear like interesting takes and stylistic characteristics, because a lot of these producers, it's on your shoulders to do the work to understand the style and their history and what they do. And it's not purely, a technological or a reference tech, but I learned a lot in this book. And I think that's one of the things I appreciate most about the books I love the most in these podcasts, is I've clearly spent the better part of my career learning, and I love it. I'm a relentless learner. I'm always trying to, improve and expand my brain. And I love it when I read something that's not only well-written and tells really, really great stories, it's also funny. I didn't even get into this part, but like, it's a little irreverent. It's a little bawdy. I don't need to like quote everything in the book, but like, they're not dirty, but they also just have that like dry British wit, and it's not G-rated. Like, there's just some funny stuff in here. So this book just, it hits on all parts of, everything I was hoping to get out of this book, that like I heard it was really great and, I wanted to like it. And I guess what I'm saying is Mike D doesn't have to buy me a glass of wine, because I did love this book and I feel very satisfied. I still want him to buy me a glass of wine. So there you go. If you, if you don't like my recommendations and you buy this book and you read it, you don't like it, well, you can take it up with him, because I don't want to hear about it. This book is awesome. And I think that you all need to have this in your collection. It's gorgeous. The only thing that's not great about it is the weird matte material on the cover, but it's such a cool book. And honestly, now all I want to do is read every issue every 4 months of Noble Rot Magazine moving forward, because these guys are, they got a thing going on and it's rad. It's super rad. So anyway, that is Wine from Another Galaxy, Noble Rot. Thanks, Dan and Mark Andrew. I like what you've done here. So I hope you enjoyed this. If you do like what you heard, then by all means, subscribe, listen. You can find us anywhere you get your pods. And hey, feel free to leave us a rating. And we will be back next week. Cheers. This episode was brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. Visit napavalley.wine to learn more about Napa Valley, where approximately 475 wineries produce more than 1,000 different wine brands. That's napavalley.wine.